This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
For yourself, first we'll be hearing from Brad Smith, and then I'll continue on with the audio of Bradley Manning at his court-martial hearing. It's compelling audio. It's not high-quality audio. Of course, we know that there are not supposed to be pictures, text, or audio released from his hearings, that they're very private, censored, I guess is the word, the true lack of transparency there. You're going to hear him, Bradley, explain how he reacted when he first saw the video of the Apache helicopter gunning down Reuters journalists in Baghdad, and then those who showed up to rescue the wounded, including a van with children in it, being shot also from aerial helicopters. We don't have time for the entire hour. In other sciencey news, Stephen Hawking has joined the academic boycott of Israel. The world-renowned physicist pulled out of the conference hosted by President Shimon Peres in protest at treatment of Palestinians. Professor Stephen Hawking is backing the academic boycott. And let's go ahead and continue on now with Brad Smith, Executive Director of Web Visions. I'm Rabia Yemin with The Digital Divide. Today I'm talking with Brad Smith, Executive Director of Web Visions. Web Visions is a multi-dimensional technology and, I don't know, arts and culture extravaganza. And what year of Web Visions is this?
We started in 2001, so this is actually our 13th year.
That's incredible, and it seems over twice as big as it was last year. It just seems like it's grown exponentially.
Well, we're really super excited this year because we've got DrupalCon and Symphony Live, two other tech conferences. Usually we're in the convention center with the Bead Fair, and I love the Bead Fair, but at least having all these different conferences that connect with what we're doing, it's really awesome because we've got people coming from all around the world, and they're doing some getting exposed to some really great programs and speakers, and I think that it's going to be one of the biggest tech events and design events for the world of digital in Portland.
Tell us about the history of the event.
Well, it started out at the Children's Theater in Northwest Portland, and we had about 150 people there. And it was 2001, right before the dot-com bubble burst for the first time. And there was a lot of anxiety, and people were kind of wondering what was going to happen next. The theater itself was an August afternoon, and was probably about 110 degrees in there. We had these gigantic fans that sounded like an airplane was taking off in there. And we had to run 50 feet of phone line from the office to get a connection via a dial-up modem to the web. You know, stark contrast to how we are today with wireless and Wi-Fi. And the speed of computers, and you know, the fact that in our pockets we have a lot of times a faster computer in our phone than we did back then in our desktop systems.
Oh yeah, right. I remember. I actually can remember saying out loud, "I'll never need more than 40 megabytes."
I know that's so ironic. You know that the more we have, the more we use, but. You know, the exciting thing is that really, if you look at the price of technology and if you look at the access for technology, the tools are there right now for people to create films, to be able to develop web pages, to do a variety of things that will let them reach out to audiences all around the world. I mean, that's kind of a revolutionary idea to think about how far we've come in just 13 years.
It's true. Share with our listeners what you're most excited about at Web Visions this year.
Well, we've got, you know, we always have a great lineup of speakers, but this year we're really super excited to have Jason Kunesh, who was the UX director for Obama for America, and one of his cohorts, Mark Trammell, who is one of, if people know Twitter, he was one of the people that helped launch Twitter, and they both worked on the campaign together. And they're going to not only do separate sessions, one of them, Jason's going to do one on the process of you know, what they had to go through for the campaign to make it all happen. And the exciting thing was that we were actually in Chicago right before the election, and he took us on a tour of the campaign headquarters, and there were probably about 600 to 800 people inside the headquarters, all of them working super hard, except for two guys playing ping pong. But everybody else was totally dedicated. And one of the things that he impressed upon us was the seriousness, but also the ability to have fun with it. And they had a cake one day, and it had written on the frosting, "Don't F this up," because it's like, you know, everybody knew it was important. But they were like, they're going to do it, and they were in it to win it, and they were really working hard so they could have fun with it. But there's a lot of other speakers like that. We have Mark Frauenfelder from Make Magazine and BoingBoing.net, super, super important, you know, contributors to the whole maker movement and to actually the web, because Boing Boing is like one of the most popular blogs on the planet.
Right.
And then we've got a bunch of speakers like on Carolyn Chandler from Manifest Digital, who's going to talk about playing for change, about how to include game theory.
She's really into the user experience. Mm-hmm. So she'll be talking about how people use software and how to design it for people, not computers.
Yeah, and also how to do it in a way to encourage people to engage with it. A lot of times, you know, we have a hard time trying to get people to, you know, truly you use something, not just like get a task done or fill out a form, but actually use your product or your service.
Right. Like there's so many apps you can download for being organized, but if you don't use them, if you download it and you look at it once, that's really not using it. So you're saying, you know, how can we create a tool that we can really engages people enough that they'll actually integrate it into their, you know, daily or weekly activities?
Yeah, and how can you make them playful in a way? You know, how can people incorporate game theory into the user side of the application so that people really want to use it? She brings up an example of this application that she uses called Zombie Run, I believe it's called, where you listen to this sound of zombies chasing you as you're running, and it kind of adds a bit of urgency, I guess, or, you know, kind of something to your run. And so it kind of, it not only makes the run kind of more challenging, but it also makes it a lot less of an exercise in running, and it makes it a little bit more like a game.
It makes it more like an exercise in escaping with your life.
Exactly.
That's actually hilarious. I know everyone right now, they're downloading the app Zombie Run. But now you'll have to go running, because if you just sit in a chair, well, the zombies are going to get you. You can't do it.
Yeah, maybe the next one's coming up will be Zombie Spreadsheet, where you have to complete the spreadsheet within a certain amount of time, or the zombies eat you or something. I don't know. But,
I imagine that there are a number of interactive experiences that people will be able to participate in at Web Visions this year. Can you tell us about a couple of those?
Well, yeah, really excited this year. We're going to actually open up the exhibit hall from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. to the general public. We'll have people demoing Arduinos, which are these really cheap and easy to use circuit boards that people can set up control systems and pet feeders and all kinds of stuff in their house. And we've got Crafty Wonderland there. They're going to be setting up an exhibit space and selling, you know, craft products there. And they're going to have demos on our main stage. And after the demos, they're going to come down and do some hands-on things. And so we've got Carrie Bai from Red Bat Press, who's going to show off portable letterpress, and people showing off how to, you know, everything from jewelry making to, you know, doing kind of geek crafty kind of things for, you know, like creating a Star Wars terrarium.
Hey, I have to rewind. You just said that someone is bringing a letterpress to a technology conference.
Yes.
Doesn't that compute?
Isn't that funny? But, you know, our thought is that, you know, there's a lot of people that are in tech and in design who are also into making and into crafting. And part of the thing that intrigues me is, can we get people to not only use their heads and use their minds, but also to use their hands. And that by creating things that have a tactile experience that connect to your passions, it makes you a more rounded designer or technologist or programmer or strategist. And, you know, it kind of pushes you out of sometimes your, maybe your areas of comfort. And I think that, not that we're trying to make people feel uncomfortable at Web Visions, we're trying to make them expand their capabilities, expand their practices. And there's a big community in the maker movement. And we think that if you are a designer, you should not just be hanging out with other designers. If you're a programmer, you shouldn't be just hanging out with other programmers. Web Visions is an opportunity for people who are designers and technologists and strategists and media people to get together and to actually try to collaborate. And by putting these, you know, crafting demos into the exhibit hall, we're giving people the chance to have a common experience where they can drop their, you know, designer name badge or, you know, ID and really just hang out with people and develop their network and grow their network and learn new things. So it's all part of the, you know, being, having a curious mind and trying to explore and find out, you know, what you can do.
Right. So the title of the event, Web Visions, it's not exclusively related to the web. It's expanded beyond that and bringing different communities really together that have overlapping interests and bringing them together as a community and expanding their contacts and their relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're doing the show in 5 cities around the world now. We're doing it right after Portland and from June 27th to 29th in Barcelona, Spain. And then we go to Chicago from the 25th to the 27th in September. And then we're back into New York at the end of February 2014 and kind of start the cycle over again.
Wait, that was 4.
Oh, and Atlanta we also go to. But we do special events. I was just in London a week and a half ago doing a service design event there at Hub Westminster, one of the meeting and co-working spaces located in downtown London. And we had about 100 people there to talk about, you know, the future of service design, and which is kind of an interesting area. It's talking about how to really think through your service that you offer from pre-service before people do it or utilize it to during the service or an activity and then afterwards. And so that really, you know, you're looking at the experience design of the service. But those are just kind of the variety of programs that we're interested in. We're trying to bring to communities around the world, and we're trying to connect those communities, getting back to what you were saying, so that people not only in Portland but elsewhere can experience the type of the growing community of people who are interested in doing collaborative, interesting work, whether it's for themselves and or for their business or for a nonprofit. And we try to bring that all together.
Pretty exciting stuff. Music at the event, there's entertainment. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, we're doing something called The Wild Portland, which is part of this. It starts on May 11th and it goes through the 25th. And we have a bunch of performances, fashion shows, and other kind of things happening there. And that's kind of leading into Web Visions, and Web Visions is a part of that. But we wanted to actually create almost like a South by Southwest-like experience here in Portland. Portland is such a unique and interesting place, and people are doing really amazing work and really don't have a fear about, you know, working with other people, collaborating, thinking about things that other people, you know, are kind of afraid to take on. We were just talking yesterday. They had a premiere for Bizarre Foods. It was featured Portland and a bunch of Portland restaurants and food makers and things. And the creativity that they showed with the people that doing this really crazy, bizarre work of, you know, salt and straw adding, like, prosciutto to ice cream. So, you know, just things that you just, you know, like a lot of times you'd think that nobody you know, would really try some of those things.
Who's crazy enough to put bacon in ice cream?
Everybody.
Yeah. You know, we have so many people, so many companies here that are really sought after all around the world, and you know, it's a testament to see Pock Pock and Salt and Straw and other places, you know, other companies going to New York, going to other cities, and they're outstandingly popular there. And you know, those kind of just like the startups in here in Portland and the region, they are treating this as an experimental kind of test ground, launch pad, where they're able to then, you know, develop and hone their craft and then, you know, bring it to the world, and doing it very, very well. So,
well, it's pretty exciting. Tell us the dates again.
It's May 22nd through 24th. It's at the Oregon Convention Center. And we're online at webvisionsevent.com.
Right, people can get the entire schedule. You can read about all the different workshops, the different performances. People can buy tickets online.
That is true, yes. We would very much appreciate everybody's support, too, for that.
That's right. Last year's event was really amazing, informative. It was hard to decide where to be at any given time. There's so much talent and information going, and this year is going to be even more difficult. And that is at the convention center.
Yep.
So this is Rabia Yeaman with the Digital Divide, and I've been talking with Brad Smith, Executive Director of Web Visions, the event that is coming up. I don't even want to call it a technology event. I don't even know what to call it. It's an all-purpose human meets computer meets music meets poetry meets makers meets fixers.
Check all of the above. Yeah, it's you know, we just like to explore the future with a bunch of crazy people who are going to take people there.
Well, let's all go along with them, because they got exciting things going on. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's Web Visions coming up here at the Portland, Oregon Convention Center, May 22nd through the 24th. Check it out at webvisionsevent.com online. Just click on Portland, and it's right now today they're calling it a visionary hootenanny. It's true. Coming up next in our broadcast today, Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Be sure and go to the website, check out past episodes and interviews, and while you're there, become a supporting member of your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Click on the donate jar. $5 a month gets you sustaining membership. Right now, we're going to hear Bradley Manning in his own voice at his hearing for court martial. Of course, as I mentioned at the beginning, my disclaimer, I haven't been able to personally, I don't have any way to personally authenticate this audio. However, if you go to The Guardian and you look up Glenn Greenwald, he is the author who has posted the article, transcript, and audio. He's a founder and board member of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And judge for yourself in this audio. Bradley Manning explains how he reacted the first time he saw Apache helicopter soldiers gunning down journalists, women and children, and his motivations for releasing the documents. You can hear the entire audio. I don't have time in the show to broadcast the entire bit, but you will hear about 35 minutes of it. It's pretty compelling. The beginning of the audio, the quality is not so good. Keep in mind, this audio is not authorized to be recorded at his hearing. They don't allow anything. So I'm not exactly sure how it was made or how it got here, but judge for yourself. Bradley Manning.
Private First Class in the United States Army, currently assigned to Headquarters and Headquarters Company, HHC, U.S. Army Garrison, USAG, Joint Base Meyer, Henderson Hall, Fort Myer, Virginia. By end of his assignment, I was assigned to AJC, 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division, at Fort Drum, New York. My primary military occupational specialty, or PMOS, is 35 Foxtrot, intelligence analyst. I entered active duty status on 2 October 2007. I enlisted with the hope of obtaining both real-world experience and earning benefits under the GI Bill for college opportunities. Facts regarding my position as an intelligence analyst. In order to enlist in the Army, I took the Standard Armed Services Aptitude Battery, or ADAP. My score on this battery was high enough for me to qualify for any enlisted MOS position. My recruiter informed me that I should select an MOS that complemented my interests outside the military. In response, I told him that I was interested in geopolitical matters and information technology. He suggested I consider becoming an intelligence analyst. After researching the intelligence analyst position, I agreed that this would be a good fit for me. In particular, I enjoyed the fact that an analyst could use information derived from a variety of sources to create work products that informed the command of its available choices for determining the best courses of action, or COAs. Although the MOS required a working knowledge of computers, it primarily required me to consider how raw information can be combined with other available intelligence sources in order to create products that assisted the command in its situational awareness, or SA. I assessed that my natural interest in geopolitical affairs and my computer skills would make me an excellent intelligence analyst. After enlisting, I reported to the Fort Meade Military Entrance Processing Station on 1 October 2007. I then traveled to and reported at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri on 2 October 2007 to begin basic combat training, or BCT. Once at Fort Leonard Wood, I quickly realized that I was neither physically nor mentally prepared to the requirements of basic training. My BCT experience lasted 6 months instead of the normal 10 weeks. Due to the medical issues, I was placed in a hold status. A physical examination indicated I sustained injuries to my right shoulder and left foot. Due to those injuries, I was unable to continue basic. During medical hold, I was informed that I may be outprocessed from the Army. However, I resisted being chaptered out because I felt I could overcome my medical issues and continue to serve. On 20 January 2008, I returned to basic combat training. This time, I was better prepared, and I completed training on 2 April 2008. I then reported for the MOS-specific Advanced Individual Training, or AIT, on 7 April 2008. AIT was an enjoyable experience for me. Unlike basic training, where I felt different from the other soldiers, I fit in and did well. I preferred the mental challenges of reviewing a large amount of information from various sources and trying to create useful or actionable products. I especially enjoyed the practice of analysis through the use of computer applications and methods I was familiar with. I graduated from AIT on 16 August 2008 and reported to my first duty station, Fort Drum, New York, on 28 August 2008. As an analyst, significant activities, or SIGACTs, were a frequent source of information for me to use in creating work products. I started working extensively with SIGACTs early after my arrival at Fort Drum. My computer background allowed me to use the tools organic from distributed common ground system Army, or D6A, computers to create polished work products for the 2nd Brigade Camp Combat Team Chain of Command. The non-commissioned officer in charge, or NCOIC, of the S2 section, then Master Sergeant David P. Atkins, recognized my skills and potential and tasked me to work on a tool abandoned by a previously assigned analyst, the Incident Tracker. The Incident Tracker was viewed as a backup to the Combined Information Data Network Exchange, or CIDNE, and as a unit historical reference tool. In the months preceding my upcoming deployment, I worked on creating a new version of the Incident Tracker and used SIGACTs to populate it. The SIGACTs I used were from Afghanistan because at the time our unit was scheduled to deploy to the Logar and Wardak provinces of Afghanistan. Later, our unit was reassigned to deploy to eastern Baghdad. At that point, I removed the Afghanistan SIGACTs and switched to Iraq SIGACTs. As an analyst, I view the SIGACTs as historical data. I believe this view is shared by other all-source analysts as well. SIGACTs give a first-look impression of a specific or isolated event. This event can be an improvised explosive device attack, or IED, small arms fire engagement, or SAF, engagement with a hostile force or any other event, a specific unit documented and reported in real time. In my perspective, the information contained within a single SIGACT or group of SIGACTs is not very sensitive. The events encapsulated within most SIGACTs involve either enemy engagements or casualties. Most of this information is publicly reported by the Public Affairs Office, or PAO, embedded media pools, or post-nation HN media. As I started working with SIGACTs, I felt they were similar to a daily journal or log that a person may keep. They capture what happens on a particular day and time. They are created immediately after the event and are potentially updated over a period of hours until a final version is published on the city, on the combined information data network exchange. Each unit has its own standard operating procedure, or SOP, for reporting and reporting SIGACTs. The SOP may differ between reporting in a particular deployment and reporting in garrison. In garrison, a SIGACT normally involves personnel issues, such as driving under the influence or DUI incidents, or an automobile accident involving the death or serious injury of a soldier. The report starts at the company level and goes up to the battalion, brigade, and even up to the division level. In deployed environment, a unit may observe or participate in an event, and a platoon leader or platoon sergeant may report the event to a SIGACT, as a SIGACT, to the company headquarters through the radio transmission operator, or RTO. The commander, or RTO, will then forward the report to the battalion battle captain, or battle, non-commissioned officer, or NCO. Once the battalion battle captain, or battle NCO, receives the report, they will either, 1, notify the battalion operations officer, or S3, 2, conduct an action, such as launching a quick reaction force, or 3, perform the event and further report it up the chain of command to the brigade. The recording of each event is done by radio or over the secret internet protocol router network, or SIPRINET, normally by an assigned soldier, usually junior enlisted, E4 and below. Once the SIGACT is reported, the SIGACT is further sent up the chain of command. At each level, additional information can either be added or corrected as needed. Normally, within 24 to 48 hours, the updating and reporting of a particular SIGACT is complete. Eventually, all reports and SIGACTs go through the chain of command from brigade to division and division to corps. At corps level, the SIGACT is finalized and published. The CIVI system contains a database that is used by thousands of Department of Defense, DOD personnel, including soldiers, civilians, and contractors at corps. It was the United States Central Command, or CENTCOM, reporting tool for operational reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Two separate but similar databases were maintained for each theater, Sydney I for Iraq and Sydney A for Afghanistan. Each database encompasses over 100 types of reports and other historical information for access. They contain millions of vetted and finalized records, including operational and intelligence report. Sydney was created to collect and analyze battle space data to provide daily operational and intelligence community, IC, reporting relevant to a commander's daily decision-making process. The CIVI I and CIVI A databases contain reporting and analysis fields for multiple disciplines, including human intelligence or human reports, psychological operations or PSYOP reports, engagement reports, counter-improvised explosive device or CIED reports, SIGACT reports, targeting reports, social and cultural reports, civil affairs reports, and human terrain reports. As an intelligence analyst, I have unlimited access to the Sydney I and Sydney A databases and the information contained within them. Although each table within the database is important, I primarily dealt with human reports, SIGACT reports, and counter-IED reports, because these reports were used to create the work product I was required to publish as an analyst. In working on an assignment, I looked anywhere and everywhere for information. As an all-source analyst, this was something that was expected. The D6A systems had databases built in, and I utilized them on a daily basis. This includes the search tools available on D6A systems on SIPRINET, such as QueryTree and the DoD and Intellink search engines. Primarily, I utilized the Sydney database using the historical and human reporting to conduct my analysis and provide a backup for my work product. I did statistical analysis on historical data, including SIGACTs, to back up analyses that were based on human reporting and produce charts, graphs, and tables. I also created maps and charts to conduct predictive analysis based on statistical trends. The State Act reporting provided a reference point for what occurred and provided myself and our panelists with the information to conclude possible outcome. Although State Act reporting is sensitive at the time of their creation, their sensitivity normally dissipates within 48 to 72 hours as the information is either publicly released, the unit involved is no longer in the area and not in danger, or the unit involved is no longer in the area and not in danger. It is my understanding that the SIG Act reports remain classified only because they are maintained within the city, because it is only accessible on SIG Land. Everything on SIG 9 and SIG A to include SIG Act reporting is treated as classified information. Facts regarding the storage of SIG Act reports. As part of my training in Fort Drum, I was instructed to ensure that I create backups of my work product. The need to create backups was particularly acute given the relative instability and reliability of the computer systems we used in the field during deployment. These computer systems included both organic and field-provided equipment, TPE, D6A machines. The organic D6A machines we brought with us into the field on our deployment were Dell MI laptops, and the TPE D6A machines were Alienware brand laptops. The M90 D6A laptops were the preferred machine to use as they were slightly faster and had fewer problems with dust and temperature than the theater-provided Alienware laptops. I used several D6A machines during the deployment due to various technical problems with the laptops. With these issues, several analysts lost information, but I never lost information due to the multiple backups I created. I intended to back up as much relevant information as possible. I would save the information so that I or another analyst could quickly access it whenever a machine crashed, Zippernet connectivity was down, or I forgot what day it was stored. When backing up information, I would do one or all of the following things based on my training. Physical backup. I try to keep physical backup copies of information on paper so that the information could be grabbed quickly. Also, it was easier to brief from hard copies of research and human reports. 2, local drive backup. I try to sort out information I deem relevant and keep complete copies of the information on each of the computers I use in the temporary sensitive compartmentalized compartmented information facility, or TSCIF, including my primary and secondary D6A machines. This was stored under my user profile on the desktop. Shared drive backup. Each analyst had access to a T drive, what we call a T drive, shared across the SIPRNet. It allowed others to access information that was stored on S6 operated the T drive. Compact disk rewritable, or CDRW backup. For larger data sets, I saved the information onto a rewritable disk, labeled disks, and stored them in the conference room of the T-scale. This redundancy permitted us the ability to not worry about information loss. If a system crashed, I could easily pull information from a secondary computer, the T-drive, or one of the CDRWs. If another analyst wanted to access my data, but I was unavailable, she could find my published products directly on the T-drive or on the CDRWs. I sorted all my products and research by date, time, and group, and updated the information on each of the storage methods to ensure that the latest information was available to them. During the deployment, I had several of D6A machines crash on me. Whenever the computer crashed, I usually lost information, but the redundancy method ensured my ability to quickly restore old backup data and add my current information to the machine when it was repaired or replaced. I stored the backup CDRWs of larger data sets in the conference room of the TSCIF or next to my workstation. I marked the CDRWs based on the classification level and its content. Unclassified CDRWs were only labeled with a content type and not marked with classification markings. Early on in the deployment, I only saved and stored the SIG acts that were within or near our operational environment. Later, I thought it would be easier just to save all of the SIG acts onto a CDRW. The process would not take very long to complete, and so I downloaded the SIG acts from Sydney High onto a CDRW. After finishing with Sydney High, I did the same with Sydney A. By retrieving the Sydney I and Sydney A SIGACs, I was able to retrieve the information whenever I needed it, and not rely upon the unreliable and slow Zippernet connectivity needed to pull. Instead, I could just find the CDRW and open the preloaded spreadsheet. This process began in late December 2009 and continued through early January 2010. I could quickly export 1 month of the CIAC data at a time and download it in the background as I did other tasks. The process took approximately a week for each table. After downloading the CIAC tables, I periodically updated them by pulling only the most recent CIACs and simply copying them and pasting them into the database saved on TNDRW. I never hid the fact that I had downloaded copies of both the CIAC tables from Sydney I and Sydney A. They were stored on appropriately labeled MRI TNDRWs stored in the open. I viewed the saved copies of the Sydney I and Sydney A CIAC tables as being both for my use and the use of anyone within the S2 section during the SuperNet connectivity issues. In addition to the CIAC tables, I had a large repository of human reports and speed and counter-IND reports downloaded from Sydney on. These contain reports that are relevant to the area in and around our operational environment in Eastern Baghdad and the Dinal province.
You're listening to unauthorized release audio of Bradley Manning speaking at his court-martial hearing in Maryland this month, I believe, from March 2013.
Secure Internet Relay Protocol Network, or Internet. I downloaded a webinar on Internet and transferred it to the D6A machine user profile desktop using a CDRW. I did not try to hide the fact that I was downloading webinar onto my SuperNet D6A machine or computer. With the assistance of the EZ2 compression algorithm using the WinRAR program, I was able to fit all of the CIACs onto a single CDRW and the relevant human encounter ID reports onto a separate CDRW. That's regarding my knowledge of the WikiLeaks organization, or WLO. I first became vaguely aware of the WLO during my AIT at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, though I did not fully pay attention until the WLO released purported short messaging system, or SMS messages, from 11 September 2001 on 25 November 2009. At that time, references to the release and the WLO website showed up in my daily Google News open source search for information related to U.S. foreign policy. The stories were about how WLO published approximately 500,000 messages. I then reviewed the messages myself and realized that the posted messages were very likely real given the sheer volume and detail of the content. After this, I began conducting research on WLO. I conducted searches on both Nipronet and Cipronet on WLO beginning in late November 2009 and early December 2009. At this time, I also began to routinely monitor the WLO website. In response to one of my searches in December 2009, I found the United States Army Counterintelligence Center, or USASIC, report on the WikiLeaks organization. After reviewing the report, I believed that this report was one of the was possibly the one that my AIT instructor referenced in early 2008. I may or may not have saved the report on my D6A workstation. I know I reviewed the document on other occasions throughout early 2010 and saved it on both my primary and secondary laptops. After reviewing the report, I continued doing research on WLO. However, based upon my open source collection, I discovered information that contradicted the 2008 USASIC report, including information indicating that, similar to other press agencies, WLO seemed to be dedicated to exposing illegal activities and corruption. WLO received numerous awards and recognition for its reporting activities. Also, in reviewing the WLO website, I found information regarding U.S. military SOPs for Camp Delta at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and information on the abandoned, outdated rules of engagement, or ROE, in Iraq for cross-border pursuits of former members of Saddam Hussein al-Sarkozy's government. After seeing the information available on the WLO website, I continued following it and collecting open source information from it. During this time period, I followed several organizations and groups, including wire press agencies such as the Associated Press and Reuters, and private intelligence agencies, including Strategic Forecasting or Stratfor. This practice was something I was trained to do during AIT and was something that good analysts are expected to do. During the searches of WLO, I found several pieces of information that I found useful in my work product in my work as an analyst. Specifically, I recall WLO publishing documents related to weapons trafficking between two nations that affected my OE. I integrated this information into one or more of my work products. In addition to visiting the WLO website, I began following WLO using an instant relay chat or IRC client called XChat sometime in early January 2010. IRC is a protocol for real-time internet communications by messaging and conferencing, colloquially referred to as chat rooms or chats. The IRC chat rooms are designed for group communication and discussion forums. Each IRC chat room is called a channel. Similar to a television, you can tune in or follow it, or follow a channel, so long as it is open and does not require an invite. Once joining a specific IRC conversation, other users in the conversation can see that you have joining the room. On the internet, there are millions of different IRC channels across several services. Channel topics span a range of topics covering all kinds of interests and hobbies. The primary reason for following WLO on IRC was curiosity, particularly in regards to how and why they obtained the SMS messages referenced above. I believed that collecting information on the WLO would assist me in this goal. Initially, I simply observed the IRC conversations. But once I learned how the organization was structured and how they obtained their data, the conversations I viewed were usually technical in nature, but sometimes switched to a lively debate on issues a particular individual may have felt strongly about. Over a period of time, I became more involved in these discussions, especially when conversations turned to geopolitical events and information technology topics, such as networking and encryption methods. Based on these observations, I would describe the WLO organization as almost academic in nature. In addition to the WLO conversations, I participated in numerous other IRC channels across at least three different networks. The other IRC channels I participated in normally dealt with technical topics, including Linux and Berkeley, secure distribution, BSD operating systems or OSs, networking, encryption algorithms and techniques, and other more political topics, such as politics and queer rights. I normally engage in multiple IRC conversations simultaneously, mostly publicly but often privately. The XChat client enabled me to manage these multiple conversations across different channels and servers. The screen for XChat was often busy, but experience enabled me to see when something was interesting. I would then select the conversation and either observe or participate. I really enjoyed the IRC conversations pertaining to and involving the WLO. However, at some point in late February or early March of 2010, the WLO IRC channel was no longer accessible. Instead, regular participants of this channel switched to using a Jabber server. Jabber is another internet communication tool, similar but more sophisticated than IRC. The IRC and Jabber conversations allowed me to feel connected to others even when alone. They helped me pass the time and keep motivated throughout the time. Facts regarding the unauthorized storage and disclosure of the SIGACs. As indicated above, I created copies of the Sydney I and Sydney A SIGAC tables as part of the process of backing up information. At the time I did so, I did not intend to use this information for any purpose other than for backup. However, I later decided to release this information publicly. At that time, I believe and still believe that these tables are two of the most significant documents of our time. On 8 January 2010, I collected the CDRW I stored in the conference room of the T-skiff and placed it into the cargo pocket of my ACU, or Army Combat Uniform. At the end of my shift, I took the CDRW out of the T-skiff and brought it to my containerized housing, or CHU. I copied the data onto my personal laptop. Later, at the beginning of my shift, I returned the CDRW back to the conference room of the T-skiff. At the time, I saved the SIGACs to my laptop. I planned to take them with me on mandatory leave and decide what to do with them. At some point prior to my mandatory leave, I transferred the information from my computer to a secure digital memory card for my digital camera. The SD card for the camera also worked on my computer and allowed me to store the SIGAC tables in a secure manner for transport. I began mandatory leave on 23 January 2010, flying from Atlanta, Georgia to Reagan National Airport in Virginia. I arrived at the home of my aunt, Deborah M. Van Alstyne, in Potomac, Maryland, and quickly got into contact with my then-boyfriend, Tyler R. Watkins. Tyler, then a student at Brandeis University in Walden, Massachusetts, and I made plans for me to visit him in Boston, Massachusetts area. I was excited to see Tyler and planned on talking to Tyler about where our relationship was going and about my time in Iraq. However, when I arrived in the Boston area, Tyler and I seemed to become distant. He did not seem very excited about my return from Iraq. I tried talking to him about our relationship, but he refused to make any plans. I also tried raising the topic of releasing the Sydney I and Sydney A SIGAC tables to the public. I asked Tyler hypothetical questions about what he would do if he had documents that he thought the public needed access to. Tyler didn't really have a specific answer for me. He tried to answer the question and be supportive, but seemed confused by the question and its context. I then tried to be more specific when he asked too many questions. Rather than try to explain my dilemma, I decided just to drop the conversation. After a few days in Waltham, I began feeling that I was overstaying my welcome, and I returned to Maryland. I spent the remainder of my time on leave in the Washington, D.C. area. During this time, a blizzard bombarded the Mid-Atlantic, and I spent a significant period of time essentially stuck at my aunt's house in Maryland. I began to think about what I knew and the information I still had in my possession. For me, the SIGACs represented the on-the-ground reality of both the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I found we were risking so much for people that seemed unwilling to cooperate with us, leading to frustration and hatred on both sides. I began to become depressed with the situation that we found ourselves increasingly mired in, year after year. The CIS documented this in great detail to provide a context to what we were seeing on the ground. In attempting to conduct counterterrorism, CT, and counterinsurgency, coin operations, we became obsessed with capturing and killing human targets on lists and on being suspicious of and avoiding cooperation with our host nation partners, and ignoring the second and third order effects of accomplishing short-term goals and missions. I believe that if the general public, especially the American public, had access to the information contained within the CIDIA and NEA tables, this could spark a domestic debate on the role of the military and our foreign policy in general, as well as related to Iraq and Afghanistan. I also believe the detailed analysis of the data over a long period of time by different sectors of society might cause society to reevaluate the need or even the desire to engage in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations that ignore the complex dynamics of the people living in the affected environment every day. At my aunt's house, I debated what I should do with the SIGACs, in particular whether I should hold on to them or expose them to a press agency. At this point, I decided it made sense to try and disclose the SIGAC tables to an American newspaper. I first called my local newspaper, the Washington Post, and spoke with a woman saying that she was a reporter. I asked her if the Washington Post would be interested in receiving information that would have enormous value to the American public. Although we spoke for about 5 minutes concerning the general nature of what I possessed, I do not believe she took me seriously. She informed me that the Washington Post would possibly be interested, but that such decisions are made only after seeing the information I was referring to and after consideration by the senior editors. I then decided to contact the largest and most popular newspaper, the New York Times. I called the public editor number on the New York Times website. The phone rang and was answered by a machine. I went through the menu to the section for news tips and was routed to an answering machine. I left a message stating I had access to information about Iraq and Afghanistan that I believed was very important. However, despite leaving my Skype phone number and personal email address, I never received a reply from the New York Times. I also briefly considered dropping into the office for the political commentary blog, Politico. However, the weather conditions during my leave hampered my efforts in traveling. After these failed efforts, I ultimately decided to submit the materials to the WLO. I was not sure if the WLO would actually publish the CIAT tables or even if they would publish. I was also concerned that they might not be noticed by the American media. However, based upon what I read about WLO through my research described above, this seemed to be the best medium for publishing this information to the world within my reach. At my aunt's house, I joined in on an IRC conversation and stated I had information that needed to be shared with the world. I wrote that the information would help document the true costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the individuals in the IRC asked me to describe the information. However, before I could describe the information, another individual pointed me to the link for the WLO website's online submission system. After ending my IRC connection, I considered my options one more time. Ultimately, I felt that the right thing to do was to release the SIGACs. On 3 February 2010, I visited the WLO website on my computer and clicked on the Submit Documents link. Next, I found Submit Your Information Online link and elected to submit the SIGACs via the underground or Tor, T-O-R, an anonymizing network by a special link. Tor is a system intended to provide anonymity online. The software routes internet traffic through a network of servers and other Tor clients in order to conceal a user's location and identity. I was familiar with Tor and had it previously installed on my computer to anonymously monitor the social media websites of militia groups operating within central Iraq. I followed the prompts and attached the compressed data files of CVI and CVA stickheads. I attached a text file I drafted while preparing to provide the documents to the Washington Post. They provided rough guidelines saying, it's already been sanitized and any source identifying information, you might need to sit on this information, perhaps 90 to 100 days, to figure out how best to release such a large amount of data and to protect the source. This is possibly one of the more significant documents of our time, removing the fog of war and revealing the true nature of 21st century asymmetric warfare. Have a good day. After sending this, I left the SD card in a camera case at my aunt's house in the event I needed it again in the future. I returned from mid-tour leave on 11 February 2010. Although the information had not yet been published, by the WLO, I felt a sense of relief by them having it. I felt I had accomplished something that allowed me to have a clear conscience based upon what I had seen, read about, and knew were happening in both Iraq and Afghanistan every day. Facts regarding the unauthorized storage and disclosure of 10 Reykjavik 13. I first became aware of the diplomatic cables during my training period in the IT. I later learned about the Department of State, or DRS, Net-Centric Diplomacy, NCD, portal from the 210 Brigade Combat Team, S2, Captain Stephen Lim. Captain Lim sent a section-wide email to the other analysts and officers in late December 2009, containing the SIPRNet link to the portal, along with the instructions to look at the cables contained within them and to incorporate them into our work product. Shortly after this, I also noticed that diplomatic cables were being referred to and processed from the core level, U.S. Forces Iraq, or ESFI. Based upon Captain Lim's direction to become familiar with its contents, I read virtually every published cable concerning Iraq. I also began scanning the database and reading other random cables that piqued my curiosity. It was around this time, in early to mid-January 2010, that I began searching the database for information on Iceland. I became interested in Iceland due to the IOC conversations I viewed in the WLO channel, discussing an issue called ICESave. At this time, I was not very familiar with the topic, but it seemed to be a big issue for those participating in the conversation. This is when I decided to investigate and conduct a few searches on Iceland to find out more. At the time, I did not find anything discussing the ICESave issue, either directly or indirectly. I then conducted an open-source search for ICESave. I then learned that Iceland was involved in a dispute with the United Kingdom and the Netherlands concerning the financial collapse of one or more of Iceland's banks. According to open source reporting, much of the public controversy involved the United Kingdom's use of anti-terrorism legislation against Iceland in order to freeze Icelandic assets for payment of the guarantees for UK depositors that lost money. Shortly after returning from mid-tour leave, I returned to the Net-Centric Diplomacy portal to search for information on Iceland and ICESave, as the topic had not abated on the WLO IRC channel. To my surprise, on 14 February 2010, I found the cable 10 Reykjavik 13, which referenced the ICESave issue directly. The cable, published on 13 January 2010, was just over 2 pages in length. I read the cable and quickly concluded that Iceland was essentially being bullied diplomatically by two larger European powers. It appeared to me that Iceland was out of viable options, was coming to the U.S. for assistance. Despite their quiet request for assistance, it did not appear we were going to do anything. From my perspective, it appeared we were not getting involved due to the lack of long-term geopolitical benefit to do so. After digesting the contents of 10 Reykjavik 13, I debated on whether this was something I should send to the WLO. At this point, the WLO had not published nor acknowledged receipt of the CVI and CVA SIGAC tables. Despite not knowing if the SIGACs were a priority for the WLO, I decided the cable was something that would be important, and I felt I might be able to ride along by having them publish this document. I burned the document, or burned the information, onto a CDRW on 15 February 2010, took it to my tube, and saved it onto my personal laptop. I navigated to the WLO website via Tor connection, like before, and uploaded the document via the secure form. Amazingly, the WLO published 10 Reykjavik 13 within hours, proving that the form worked they must have received the CIA tape. That is regarding the unauthorized disclosure, unauthorized forge and disclosure of the 12 July 2007 Aero Weapons Team, or AWT, video. During the mid-February 2010
timeframe. All right. We're going to have to wrap it up for Digital Divide. You can get all that audio online at The Guardian, Huffington Post. I'll post it on the KABU website, Digital Divide. Thanks so much for tuning in, Don Jacobson's coming up. Is it Tracy Grammer Day?
She's not going to be here.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm sure that he has an amazing show for you lined up. So you know the deal. Keep your radio turned on. Radio will keep you turned on. And thanks for listening. Second Friday of every month, Digital Divide, KBOO Portland. It's time for the KABU News at Noon for Friday, May 10th. I'm Kristen Yount. The United States Post Office reports a loss of $1.9 billion at the end of the second quarter. Losses are down significantly from last year. However, agency expects to continue to report losses without congressional intervention. Prepayment of employee benefits and a six-day delivery schedule is something that can only be changed by a congressional act. In the last 6 months, the U.S. Postal Service has reduced career employees by 31,000, eliminated 350 delivery routes, and reduced work hours in 5,000 offices. In Iraq, midday Muslim prayers ended with more sectarian violence. A bomb was detonated as worshippers were leaving the Al-Satan Mosque in Mahawil, 35 miles south of Baghdad. Three are dead and seven were injured. This is the latest in several deadly attacks targeting Sunni Muslims. A group called Ceasefire Oregon is sponsoring a gun buyback tomorrow, Saturday, May 11th, from 10 to 2 p.m. at the Linwood Friends Church at 835 Southeast 162nd Avenue. To earn a gift card for area retailers ranging from $150 to $10 per weapon, bring in your handguns, assault rifles, or regular rifles and shotguns. Pellet guns and BB guns will also be accepted. Ceasefire Oregon is a political advocacy and education group that is sponsoring four Senate bills this session for tighter background checks, gun-free schools, public buildings, and requirements that those desiring a concealed carry permit must first take a class in person. Mayor Charlie Hales is to put his life on the line for pedestrian safety. Hales plans to pose as a decoy next Thursday during the morning rush hour traffic from 7:30 to 9 a.m. He will do this at the marked crossing at East Burnside Street and 16th Avenue. The crosswalk enforcement actions are devised by the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Portland Police Department. Placing a pedestrian decoy at crosswalks to trap and sight careless drivers who don't readily stop for them. Jaywalking pedestrians should expect to be targeted for ticketing as well. The actions will happen once a month. To request a crosswalk action in your community, contact the Transportation Bureau directly. A garment worker was found alive after being trapped in the rubble of a Bangladeshi factory complex that collapsed 17 days ago. Reshma will live. She cried, save me, from a gap between a beam and a column as recovery teams combed through the debris. The 19-year-old may have been able to collect water and had food to eat for the first 15 days. The weather today is an exquisite treat with highs in the mid-80s and unavoidable sunshine. It should last through tomorrow, but enjoy it while you can. That's all for the news headlines today. I'm Kristen Yount. Join us here Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news, baked right here by helper elves in our own little Southeast Portland oven.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Corvallis, Albany, 100.7, and in the Columbia Gorge and Hood River at 91.9.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
Listener KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson, and the program is Moving On. And I feature contemporary and traditional folk music. Moving On is here every Friday from 12 noon to 1:30, and I alternate with Laurie Sonnenfeld. I had planned to have Tracy Grammer here in the studio, but unfortunately she could not make it. But I do have some recordings of her, and I'll be sharing that with you a little bit later in the program. I'm going to kick off the program with a selection from Kim and Reggie Harris's CD called Resurrection Day. And we're going to hear, what are we going to hear? We're going to hear Look 'em in the Eye.